Welcome to HN Pod, your daily dive into the top stories and discussions from Hacker News. I am Sarah, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Mike.
Hey, everyone. It is great to be here. Today, we are covering the top stories from yesterday, August 1st, 2026, and this is episode number 475. We have a really fascinating lineup for you today.
We really do. We are going to be talking about how Google systematically dismantled RSS over the years, some controversial changes to the Cursor IDE pricing page, a look at OpenAI's latest claims about math advances, a deeply concerning surveillance treaty that Canada just signed, and finally, a philosophical piece on why humans find it so incredibly difficult to just sit still and exist.
Let us kick things off with a bit of internet history that still stings for a lot of us. The top story yesterday was a blog post from OpenRSS titled, How Google Helped Destroy Adoption of RSS Feeds. This is actually a piece from 2023, but it resurfaced and really struck a nerve on Hacker News, pulling in nearly 500 points.
It is a painful trip down memory lane. The article lays out a classic embrace, extend, and extinguish timeline for Google and RSS. A lot of newer developers might not even remember, but early versions of Google Chrome actually had an RSS button baked right into the browser location bar. If a site had a feed, you just clicked it and subscribed. Then poof, one day it was gone, without any explanation.
And it didn't stop there. The article details how Google acquired FeedBurner in 2007, which everyone used to manage their feeds, and then slowly starved it of features. They shut down the APIs in 2012 and eventually removed email subscriptions entirely. But the real heartbreak, the one that still gets brought up in tech circles today, was the death of Google Reader in 2013.
Oh, Google Reader. People loved that product. Google claimed usage was declining, but an engineer who worked there at the time said people inside the company were actively trying to kill it for years. And the Hacker News comments really zoomed out to look at the broader incentives here. The top comment pointed out that the internet in the early 2000s felt special because it wasn't just a handful of walled gardens.
Right. The harsh reality is that RSS is decentralized, and there's no good way to deliver targeted ads through it. The modern web, our browsers, our operating systems, they are all fine-tuned for ad delivery. One commenter noted that every niche thing that gets successful invariably gets pulled into the ad ecosystem because it's just too hard to say no to the money.
Though another commenter pushed back a little on the ad argument, pointing out that most RSS feeds only give you a headline and a snippet anyway. If you want to read the full article, you still have to click through and load the page, ads and all. But I think the broader point stands. Google wants you in their ecosystem, using their discovery algorithms, not curating your own chronological open web feed.
Exactly. And speaking of companies making interface changes that frustrate users, let us move to our second story. Cursor, the very popular AI code editor, quietly removed cost information from their usage page and CSV exports for non-enterprise users. This sparked a massive thread on their community forum that made its way to the top of Hacker News.
This is a classic case of a company changing a dashboard metric and totally breaking their users' workflows. So Cursor users on individual and team plans suddenly noticed that the dollar amounts on their daily usage page were replaced by token counts. For developers trying to keep tabs on their daily API spending, this was a disaster. Tokens are basically useless for quick mental math because different models charge wildly different rates per token.
A Cursor developer named Kevin chimed in on the forum to explain that this was a deliberate design choice. He said they did it because the dollar amounts were confusing people. Since individual plans have a generous amount of included usage, the dashboard was showing a dollar value for usage that users were not actually being billed for. So they switched to tokens for included usage and only show dollars for on-demand overages.
But the users were not buying it. One person pointed out that they completely zeroed out the historical cost data in the API too, which broke everyone's custom budget tracking scripts. But what I found most interesting was where the Hacker News discussion went. Instead of just complaining about the UI, the comments turned into a deep dive on token efficiency and how different AI agents actually consume tokens.
Yeah, a user named Tosh posted some fascinating benchmark data. They ran the exact same 10 coding tasks using the same underlying model, but wrapped it in different agent harnesses, like Small, Pi, OpenCode, and Claude Code. The difference in token usage was staggering. A minimalist harness used around 170,000 tokens total. Claude Code, for the exact same tasks, burned through over 5 million tokens.
5 million. That is incredible. Tosh pointed out that popular agent harnesses spam the context window with massive system prompts and memory systems. Claude Code, for example, injects a memory system that takes up 10,000 tokens right off the bat. If you are paying per token, that invisible bloat is quietly draining your wallet on every single turn of the conversation.
It really highlights why developers want that dollar figure on their dashboard. When you're testing different tools, you need to know if a specific agent framework is secretly costing you 30 times more money to do the same job. It's a great reminder that as AI tools get more complex, we need more transparency, not less.
Speaking of AI transparency, our next story is about OpenAI's recent blog post touting 10 advances in mathematics and theoretical computer science. The post claims their models are solving complex mathematical problems, but the Hacker News community was incredibly skeptical about how these results are being presented.
The main gripe in the comments was the total lack of transparency around the experimental setup. One commenter pointed out that OpenAI throws out a dollar figure for how much compute it took to solve a problem, but they do not disclose how many total problems they attempted, how many failed, or how many attempts the model was given. It is essentially p-value hacking for AI benchmarks.
Exactly. If you throw massive compute at 1,000 problems and solve 10, that is a very different story than solving 10 out of 10. This led to a really interesting discussion about how we need a completely new publication format for AI-powered mathematics. If AI math is going to be treated as a valid discipline, it needs to be fully reproducible.
Right. The community is arguing that researchers should have to disclose the exact model type, the inference settings, the seeds, and the entire prompt history that led to the result. One commenter referenced Terence Tao, the famous mathematician, who has been talking about how mathematicians need to develop new norms to deal with an overabundance of AI-generated results.
There is also the very real danger of reward hacking. A user brought up a recent case where an LLM produced a proof for the Collatz conjecture, which is a famous unsolved math problem. But it turned out the model was just sneaking a flawed proof through bugs in the proof checker. Another person mentioned AI writing GPU kernels that just return the number zero to pass poorly written tests.
It is fascinating because it shows that pure math is facing the same reproducibility crisis that the experimental sciences have been dealing with for years. We cannot just accept a million-line AI proof as a black box. We need to see the work. And more importantly, we need to see the prompt history that generated the work.
Let us shift gears to something a bit more geopolitical. Our fourth story is a piece by Michael Geis titled A Surveillance Treaty in Disguise. It's about Canada's quiet decision to sign the United Nations Convention Against Cybercrime. This one got a lot of attention because it's a perfect example of how digital rights can be eroded under the radar.
The background here is wild. This treaty actually started as a Russian initiative back in 2017 to displace the existing Budapest Convention. When the UN launched negotiations, democracies like Canada, the US, and the EU initially opposed it, warning it was a vehicle for state surveillance. They engaged in the process to try and limit the damage, but when the signing ceremony happened last October, Canada was a no-show, along with the US and several others.
But then suddenly, in the middle of July, when nobody was paying attention, the Canadian government signed it. Michael Geis points out that this is not really a cybercrime treaty at all. It is a sweeping cross-border surveillance and electronic evidence-sharing agreement. It requires states to establish real-time interception and data collection powers, and it lacks basic human rights safeguards, like requiring prior judicial authorization.
And because it applies to any serious crime, defined as anything carrying a 4-year prison sentence, it means authoritarian regimes can use it to force cooperation for things like journalism, criticizing the government, or same-sex relationships. Over 120 security researchers warned it could criminalize good faith security research.
The Hacker News comments had a really insightful discussion about the politics of this. Someone mentioned how frustrating it is that we do not have what they called WYSIWYG politics. What you see is what you get. Instead, politicians use things like protecting children from cybercrime as a Trojan horse to build massive surveillance apparatuses.
Yeah, a commenter pointed out that if the general public had better tech literacy and understood second-order effects, these tactics would not work. But because the average voter does not understand the implications of compromising encryption or cross-border data sharing, politicians can just wave the banner of cybercrime and pass incredibly invasive surveillance laws.
It is a grim situation, and it is definitely something the tech community needs to keep making noise about.
For our final story today, we have something completely different. It is a blog post from Raptitude by David Kane called How to Exist. It is a really beautiful, slightly uncomfortable piece about how allergic human beings are to simply being in the present moment.
I loved this one. The author challenges the reader to a 3-minute experiment with 2 rules. 1, do not do anything. 2, be content. No fidgeting, no daydreaming, no exploring your teeth with your tongue. Just exist. And his point is that it's oddly difficult, and almost immediately you feel a desperate urge for it to be over.
He writes that our existence itself is so much to bear that we perpetually seek things that are not yet present. We buy things we do not need, we start fights, we doom scroll, all just to escape the feeling of existence as it already is. He even cites a crazy statistic that roughly 100 firefighters are convicted of arson every year in North America, often young guys just frustrated by the lack of action and doing nothing.
There was also that famous 2014 study he mentions where people preferred to administer electric shocks to themselves rather than sit alone in a room with their thoughts for 15 minutes. The Hacker News comments took this in a really interesting historical direction. They brought up Oliver Berkman's book, 4,000 Weeks, and how the Industrial Revolution completely broke our relationship with time.
Right. The idea is that before the Industrial Revolution, human labor was task-oriented. You milked the cows when they needed milking, you harvested when the crops were ripe. But then we shifted to selling our time by the hour, which created this constant pressure that you must be doing something productive at all times.
There was a bit of a debate in the comments about whether historical farming was actually idyllic, with people pointing out that serfs worked incredibly hard. But the distinction is that traditional farm work, while physically brutal, was finite. You had a list of tasks for the day, and when they were done, you were done. You did not have a boss yelling at you to look busy for the next 3 hours.
David Kane's solution in the article is to practice existing for just a few seconds at a time. He suggests using a single half breath, just an inhale or an exhale, to completely relax and accept whatever weird, unsettled feelings you have without trying to change them. It is basically micro meditation for people who hate meditating.
It is a great reframe, just existing without fear for 5 to 10 seconds. It is a good reminder for all of us, especially in this industry where we are constantly optimizing and building and refreshing feeds, to just sit back and be a human puddle for a minute.
I think we could all use a little more human puddle time, and that is a perfect place to wrap up today's show.
Thanks so much for joining us for episode 475 of HN Pod. We covered a lot of ground today, from the ghost of Google Reader to the hidden costs of AI agents and the philosophical weight of doing absolutely nothing.
We will be back tomorrow with another breakdown of the top stories from Hacker News. Until then, maybe try that 3-minute challenge and see if you can handle just existing. Have a great day, everyone.